And once again, we find ourselves recording another Lean Into Art cast, a show where two visual storytellers get together and take a walk around a tricky or, wriggly, oily, slippery topic.
We usually start out with picturesque.
What was that?
It can be beautiful and picturesque as well. Peaceful.
That's true. It could be, you know, the beatific, sublime imagery that makes us stop and wonder that such a thing could exist. That's where mythology comes from, after all. We usually start out with a curveball to warm ourselves up, get our brains attuned to this idea of deconstructing and wrestling with the topic in abstract, which leads us to the 10,000 feet up, where we pick apart the topic in a more abstract sort of way. But then we want to leave you with something useful, so we zoom down onto the ground with some tips, tools, resources, and other things to put these abstract thoughts into action. My name is Jerzy Droz, cartoonist and teaching artist, that other guy.
I'm Rob Stenzinger. I do user experience and game design.
And
hey, Jerzy.
And you make fun.
Well, what do you think? Do we have a curveball for one another? Or are we going to just jump right into our audience supplied curveball?
Well, actually, where I want to start this week is here's my curveball for you. Reading any good books lately? I don't mean that as a joke. It just sounds like a bad joke. No, I mean, like, are you reading anything? You know, like, we talk about it when it comes up in the conversation, but I know that you're a huge reader. So what are you reading right now?
Let's see. Well, recently I got through Daniel H. Pink's To Sell as Human. Went through that a couple times. I got the audiobook and really enjoyed it. And it's not that long. And yet has pretty packed full of information. And
what's the log line of that book?
You know, what's funny is the lead of it is essentially, hey, let's explore the process of selling, even though it might feel distasteful to you. Like you may have an impression of what selling is, that's, you know, probably based on your own experience that just isn't that appealing. And then it tries to explain how, well, common it is for all of us to need to deal with as being actual salespeople. And then it actually puts it in very much a UX context to say that there's a lot of human factors and natural need to selling.
I've been reading the book. You talked me into it. It didn't take much, but you were so enthusiastic about the book. I was like, all right, I'll get it. And he makes a lot of cases for how, like, what the history of the image of the salesperson was, and how that's evolved over time, and how in our current economy and our current society, the way the internet and the way things have opened up and things have changed, is that it's time for us to reevaluate this idea, and it's no longer the carpetbagger or the door-to-door salesman who's trying to sell something that they don't believe in. We've always been pushing things we believe in, and right. That's one of the key ideas of that thing.
And selling in what you're trading isn't only just, currency and, whatever your currency of trade is, wherever you live,
currency of attention, of time, of anything that's a resource to us, right?
Yeah. And actually, I would say, I don't know, this may seem kind of odd, but I really think it wanders into useful areas that are near the selling, as far as finding a way to build the skill and explore it, which to me really, it reminds me a lot of other business philosophy books that they, you know, may have some good techniques along with them. And I wonder if in a few years, if this thing's going to be kind of big, and then like it, so, and with that, it would get its detractors and saying, oh, whatever, every manager reads that. And
it becomes the, who moved my cheese.
Yes. Well, which, I don't think it could become that, unless he ripped out most of the pages.
I've got a book recommendation to throw out at the top. I'm almost done with Invisible Ink by Brian McDonald. And Leonid to Art instructor Brandon Dayton recommended it to me. And it is a practical guide to building stories that resonate. And some very interesting thoughts in there. I know that Invisible Ink and Brian McDonald gets mentioned a lot on the Paper Wings podcast, another show very similar to Leonid to Art by Chris Oatley and Laura Innes. You can look for paperwingsshow.com. I'll put that in the show notes. But yeah, it's a pretty interesting book with some interesting thoughts about, writing elements, like getting to why the audience should care about the things that are happening in your story. And writing in, like really taking an interesting viewpoint into character motivation and staying on theme with your escalations of plot and tension. It's just a really nice refresher course in how to write stories that people will give a darn about. And it's a breezy read, but it's a thought-provoking read. So,
Will it teach me how to make people cry for the right reason?
Cry for the right reason?
I don't know. Well, as opposed to saying, oh, I wish I didn't spend the money on this.
Yes. He uses a lot of examples of films that you and I would be familiar with. Talks about, mm-hmm. Films of the 80s like E.T., Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Mm-hmm. And points out, but then he also goes to classics like Wizard of Oz, what they did right? And how, he talks about this thing called the armature. The armature is like what I would call the theme, the underlying structure of the story and like the big idea of your story. And you hang all the actions of the characters on that armature so mm-hmm. that all their actions reflect this central core idea. And like in the Wizard of Oz, every character has what they're questing for all along, right? The Scarecrow constantly demonstrates that he does indeed have brains, even though he says he doesn't have brains. The Tin Man is always welling up with tears over concern for his compatriots, but he says he doesn't have a heart, but of course he has a heart, and so on. All reflected back to the central idea that Dorothy expresses in the plot when she says, I guess if I want to look for... how does the line go? It's like, if I really want to find what my heart is looking for, I just need to look in my backyard or something like that. The idea of the treasure being in your backyard all along, but you have to go in quest into the strange places to discover that. And that's all this idea of reflecting into the treasure being inside of us and all that stuff. Anyway, interesting read. It's only $5 on the Amazon Kindle store. So it's an inexpensive read comparatively. With that, I just thought instead, in lieu of curveball, I actually warm up with talking.
That's funny. I think that's a great idea. Yeah.
Cool. I'm glad I didn't blindside you with that. We got a couple other things that I want to do, some like kind of not housekeeping stuff, but just a reminder, we don't talk about the other things that we're doing all that much on the show. And longtime listeners, and we can actually say that now because we're in episode 75. We're 3/4 of the way to 100 episodes, Rob. Longtime listeners will remember that we used to end every show with a section called Takeaways, where we'd reflect on our week in the studio and say, here's like three things that, kind of random, kind of half coalesced thoughts that I'm trying to smoosh together into some kind of coherent reflection on our week. And we kind of got forced out of the show with the new structure that we've been playing with and with the quests and everything. And plus we have a hell of a time fitting in all of our notes into the time frame that we usually have. That's another thing. I mean, like, I don't think folks realize that we usually put together about 4 to 5 pages of notes for every episode that we do.
Oh, man.
But we're still doing the takeaways, and there's a way to get them.
Well, yeah, exactly. They're not gone. They actually just moved primarily to this, the second podcast that we do. And I'm sorry, actually, if that's a surprise, but hey, good news, right? We do a second podcast and it's called Extra Lean. So Extra Lean is just a bit more informal. And well, it's so funny because we will be, just a little more, loosen the collar a little bit and maybe a little extra silly, but actually we get plenty analytical still in that one. It just depends. It's more of that. We we don't have the 5 pages of notes when we start recording for an extra lien. And we'll often mention that in the beginning.
Yeah.
But then we'd end up, you know, delving into like takeaways and our reactions from some of the things that we've been trying to work on it's a lot of fun. And how you actually find out where this secret thing is you sign up for our newsletter and we send you links to the episodes. And once you find out where it is, then you'll be able to subscribe to it, I suppose, too.
True.
But then again, you also get some extra, you know, fun thoughts and commentary in our newsletter that you don't get anywhere else. And I am actually working on a new newsletter right now, and I have 2 extra lien episodes to post, which will be going up this week.
So actually now would be a good time to sign up, because then you'd be getting 2 extra new shows, which I have to say, I mean, is it undeserved pride? I don't know, but I think they were pretty good.
Yeah, I think it's fun. It's so we get the, it's like we're finding a way to have our more formal podcast with the structure that Jersey described. And we're really finding that we're enjoying that, and we're getting good feedback from the audience and in various emails and different, you know, comments and whatnot. It sounds like that's working really well, but then what's cool is the other stuff was fun too. And well, it's not gone.
Yep. Just moved. And we just put it in a place where it's for the people who actually get the most out of the show and don't mind getting an email a month from us with some fun resources and links and things. And then also, I should say, we are on Tumblr, we are on Google+, we are on Facebook, we are on, is that it?
Let's see.
I don't mean us personally. I mean like Lean Into Art has a presence in those places.
Oh yeah, Lean Into Art is. Yeah. Right. I think those are the main outlets. Tumblr, Facebook, Google+.
Okay. Yeah. And I've been using Twitter. The Tumblr to reblog like awesome art resources. Like whenever I find like a really cool tutorial or just like a simple chart of like different hand poses, I'm posting it to the Tumblr, trying to also do it to the Google+. Rob's got control of the Facebook, but wherever you play nice with other people on the internet, we are usually there as well. So you can find us in all those places. But do go to leanintart.com and click on that newsletter link, and then you can get the extra liens if you want them. So there's one more thing, Rob. You drew a thing and you worked really hard on this thing and you posted a process post about it.
Yeah, I did. I did a commission book cover which was a collaboration for a book that a friend of mine wrote. Pete Gilbertson. What's that?
Can you screen share the cover so we can see?
Yes, I can.
Gotta go to agz.me.
No, you're right. That's awesome. All right, let's do this. Screen
you need
share.
To see this because you worked your butt off on this thing.
Desktop 2. All right, are you seeing it?
Yes.
There it is. No, that's the, these are the early concept sketches. So I'm actually scrolling through the process post. And I used a fairly comics styled process. It didn't begin as like a painting with values and whatnot that I was, you know, building shapes out of and whatnot. But I did a typical, sketches and then, you know, blue line and pen and whatnot, all the way up to essentially, you know, color flats and then exploring the color a bit. And finally landing on the final cover, which I might need to zoom out a little bit to be able to see. Zoom out. No. And so, yeah, this is it's a horror book it's really gruesome. Like if you're in, it's really gruesome. So this is not the bedtime story for the family kind of thing. Zombies at the Gates is the lead story in the book, and Pete has a couple others in there as well. So yeah, the book's Zombies at the Gates and Other Tales, and it's on Amazon Kindle right now.
So and did you link to it on the process post at AGC?
Yes, I did. Yep.
Okay.
Totally.
Do you get anything out of the deal if they sell any books?
Yeah, actually I do.
So then people should go buy it. If you like zombies and you like Rob, then you should go get this book to support Rob.
And if you like Rob Zombie as well, that's incidental.
Sorry, Rob, go ahead.
No worries. Too easy. All right. So yeah, anyway, it was a lot of fun. I mean, it was not like a full-time gig for a few weeks or whatnot, but it was a very iterative process, discovering, you know, how the cover, what should be on the cover as a subject that was representative of the story, that was evocative enough. If you think about this from a user experience perspective, what's the purpose of a book cover? Well, it's meant to, you know, in a situation where you want to help someone and, well, be, well, convincing, to guide them to a decision you'd like, when they see the book, you want them to be curious. So you get their attention. It's the classic thing that I think, I've not seen the movie yet, but Glengarry Glen Ross, I guess, Alec Baldwin wrote the acronym on the, you know, there's chalkboard or whatever, ADA, right? Attention, interest, decision, and action, right? So when you have a book cover, you're starting to bring someone from attention, you get their attention, and in interest, they're beginning to interact with it to then discover more. And then really it's up to the rest of the listing in the store to help bring them into decision and action. But yeah, book cover helps out with the first part of that. So,
well, cool. It looks good, Rob.
Thanks, man.
It looks like it was some work. A lot of zombies on there.
Yeah, it was. Well, if you go back, I mean, it was a lot of fun. I mean, it's especially interesting. You go from this stage, and then there's a particular zombie that got added because of, well, it's kind of an important zombie in the gruesome tale. And this little guy in the background, the hulking one. And anyway, other things were amplified and whatnot to essentially, it was funny how I had an inspiration when I went to tackle this that I had no, like, you ever have an inspiration that has almost nothing to do with the subject or not enough to do with the subject, but you just, it's moving you forward anyway. Mm. I was thinking about the movie poster for Vertigo, mm-hmm. for this, just because there's a certain aspect of it that's gut-wrenching. And I was like, how could I cause that in this situation anyway? And it was just helping guide me a little bit, like having the dude fall away and whatnot. And yeah. even in one of the iterations, I had in Photoshop a crazy spiral in the background, but that was bad. Got rid of it.
No, I like the way it is now with all the negative space too, because you have all that cacophony of zombie mayhem behind the gate, right? But then nice negative space around the outside to, like, keep your attention on the conflict between the man falling back and the zombies, right? You don't need anything else in there.
That was fun too, as far as fine tuning and what to include and whatnot and all that. I always love that as far as any design problem, visual or otherwise. So yeah, that was a ton of fun. And one of those, it was a cool project, but it wasn't on my initial calendar there. So bonus project.
Bonus project. I'm gonna have to start using positive language like that when I get overworked.
Achievement unlocked.
Achievement unlocked. You get bonus project this week.
Yeah. Less sleep.
Yeah. All right. Well, we will link to that in the show notes. That's at agz.me. And speaking of being at the gates, oh my gosh. I think we're gonna get to main topic. Oh, and I lost Rob. The music was so intense.
It's been
intense.
A while since that happened. Hey.
Music was so intense, it knocked you out of the hangout.
Don't like missing my good Robotech segues there.
All right. So, okay, we got a topic. And this one came from another listener to the show, or viewer of the show, I guess we should say, because it is audio and video now. Tyrell Pinnegar. And I'll read the email in a second, but I just want to say two things at the top. One, we love getting emails from you guys because we want to know what you are struggling with so we can build episodes around that. We're going to talk a little bit about services later on, right? But also, one of the reasons I love getting listener or viewer emails is because it sometimes they address questions that I myself am struggling with. And this is one of the great things about teaching is it forces you to think about why you do what you do and be more mindful about what you're doing. And often when a student asks me a question about a topic that I wasn't prepared to deal with, and because I'm not the kind of teacher who says, we're not talking about that today, shut up, but instead say, well, that's an interesting question, let's try to figure it out. I get a direct benefit out of this. In doing the notes for this episode, I was like, you know what? I need to think about this way more often when I'm doing my stuff, right? I'm guessing it's the same for you, Rob, or maybe not.
No, not really. I just think about what I already know and I choose to impart. There's so much an adventure of just jumping in and adapting and discovering and helping be a and just helping share that discovery, essentially. So I'm not trying to disguise it like, oh yeah, I knew this answer 20 years ago or whatever. Not at all. I think that you're right as far as teaching whatnot. The one thing that we tend to thematically come back around to from time to time with the Lean Into Hardcast and whatnot is it's great to go teach something. We've built Lean Into Hard as a, it's not just, Jersey and Rob here. We actually, we have other teaching artists that we've reached out to, and some of them, they're new to it. Some others like are trained teachers, right? And like, that's what their degree is in or whatnot. And either way, the process of teaching and especially teaching something that there's this transition from tacit knowledge when you're like, this is something that I'm really trying to understand more of, you're like, yeah, I can do that. What do you need? Oh, okay, cool. I'll go do it. Like, do a book cover commission or something, or do a, one of these quests even, right? I find myself, even if I wrote the quest and I had some presumptions going into it, by going on the quest and asking these questions and whatnot, and then sharing it, this, which is writing a blog post about it. I mean, we're kind of tricking y'all into teaching. I'm being silly, but yeah.
It's the same idea. Yeah.
I mean, you're really doing some teaching, conveying your experience and your thoughts that went into this, so others can sort of absorb your process to some extent, however deep or not you want to go. And anyway, that's a transformative experience. You're going to be different once you start doing that.
Yep. So that's all to say that we love getting emails from you guys. So if there's something that you've been wondering about and say, I wonder what Rob would think of this, then you can find the contact form on the Lean Into Art website and don't hesitate to get in touch with us, because often you guys give us questions that spiral off into 5 pages of notes as we're trying to deconstruct the question and figure it out. So I'm going to read Tyrell's email because he gave us permission to. That is one of the things on the form, on the contact form. Yeah, if you want us to read on there, you have to give us permission. And don't forget, if you want us to give you a web shout out, include your URL. So email from Tyrell. I've had a question on my mind for several months now, but it only now occurred to me that it might make a good curveball. I've been working on a long-term graphic novel project for over 2 years now. Current estimates suggest I have at least 5 or 6 more years until it's completed. It can take that long. That's me editorializing. I've been keeping the project mostly under wraps, showing it only to my family and friends and the occasional objective stranger. My plan had always been to complete the graphic novel before publicly releasing any information. But lately, I've seen many creators using development blogs, previews, online serialization, and social media to build an audience even several years before the project is ready for release. So my question is this. Under what circumstances is it appropriate to make the progress of your project public? Are there any advantages to lying low until the project is fully completed? Yours truly, Tyrell. Thank you, Tyrell. That's a really good question, right?
Oh, yeah.
I want to kick it off. It was we go into this abstract discussion. I think this is later on in my notes, but it was so timely that he sent this email because I just watched this a lecture by Neil Gaiman on being like dandelions. Did you see the post I did on that, Rob? I don't think you had time to watch it, did you?
I did not.
No, it was like a half hour talk, and I just was listening to it while I was doing some freelance illustration work. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that I loved about the talk, it's another, you know, hip, hip, hooray for online sharing. Hooray, we can do these amazing things. And sometimes we do these silly little things that blossom into wonderful things. And he talks about this metaphor of dandelions, which I guess he cribbed from Cory Doctorow. I'm not sure. You can find the link on my Google Plus feed. And we'll link to it in the show notes. But this idea of, you know, as mammals, we raise a child for 20 years and we nurture it and we nurture it. And we invest a lot into that kid. And dandelion just spits out bunches of little seeds. And some of them turn into things, some of them don't. Dandelion doesn't care. Just throw the seeds out there. And so he's saying that the future of publishing is something like that. But then he also points out where the dandelion model doesn't work. He talks about an experience with Art Spiegelman where they try to replicate something he did that went viral before, and it didn't happen. And he said, so sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. So protect your work, lie low. Yeah, sure. Share openly. Yeah, sure. Just make sure you're doing things. This was the basis of his talk. and I love that he sort of said, like, instead of take, it was even-handed, in my opinion. And I was really grateful or happy that he talked about the times when it didn't work as well. So it didn't turn into like this big hip, hip, hooray. Everybody needs to share things openly. And that, I think, encapsulates this beginning as we deconstruct the question. If the answer is it's up to you and it depends, then we need to deconstruct the question, Rob.
Yeah, I agree. Because it's easy to just back away and say, well, it depends. All right, next question. And well, why does it depend? And what are some of the other situations? I think you've presented the moderate perspective. While I've not seen that, it really sounds like, okay, so Neil was very even-handed. And I think that a lot of times we come across sources of advice from people that we trust or we feel connection with from, you know, through podcasts or blogs or whatever, Twitter. And it just sounds so bold and so clear and so that you're like, well, that's got to be fact, I guess, right? Where I can see one of these perspectives that would be more of a think about someone who is in a larger funded business model where they're saying, you know, they're looking at a project and they're like, I'm not investing 6 years. You know, we're going to figure this out a lot quicker than that. And in fact, you've already wasted a lot of my time. So let's move on, right? And do whatever really super quick process we do to incrementally increase our risk on this project and abandon it if we see it going the wrong way. And so you'd have that super severe business perspective on one side. And I'm not characterizing that as bad. They have to do that to make their machine keep working. Their machine falls apart if they say, anyone who shows up in the next 5 minutes, we're making your story. And then, great. They need to look at it in ways that fit their market, their business, and how they produce, all that kind of stuff. I mean, they're, you know, they have a business to run.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, yeah. And nothing wrong with that.
But it's easy to get caught up in biases, and of course we have our own biases as well. So with all the reason I think deconstructing the question is important as well is to try to be as objective as you possibly can, knowing that you can never quite get to that last decimal point, right? There's always gonna be some. Go ahead.
Well, and then I think it's helpful to think of strong voices at different points along that continuum because they become like your advisors in like, playing Civilization or something. You're just listening to your different advisors where you're like, oh, okay, that sounds like a good idea, or no, where, because on the other end, you could have someone that's really into just, you know, get into the practice and do the, you know, something more like, well, the Lean Into Art Cast or something, like just go make stuff and practice and share it and reflect on it kind of thing. And then toward the, you know, the next part of that would be more of a, think about like the classic webcomics model of like, well, you've got to do it a certain way, because I've seen success in the incremental sharing because of all these reasons that worked for me and my audience. And then, well, of course, that's exactly what you have to do because it worked for me and my audience.
Right. So I think another point to hit in from an abstract point of view is just as, not I wouldn't say a disclaimer, but more of a re-emphasis on a recurring theme in here that's important to understand when we're evaluating this big idea of whether we should lie low with our projects or walk tall with our projects, whether we should keep it hidden and release it all in one big go as an event or something, or whether we should release it incrementally to build an audience. Make no mistake, either path, I think, means years and years of toil. Right? It's like there's always, and this is something that more and more authors say all the time, is like, you know, they say like it's the overnight success. Yeah, the overnight success that took 10 years to get to, right? Because from the audience's point of view, yesterday I hadn't heard of this guy, today I have. He came out of nowhere. We get caught up in that spectacle of it, ignoring the fact that, no, this person worked their butt off for many, many years to get to where they are. And they just happen to hit your radar today. So whether you decide to do something incrementally or whether you decide to keep everything under wraps and have like this kind of long-term goal, both ways are long and painful. Just as finding a publisher or self-publishing are both equally difficult paths, and they have their own pros and cons, right? So, okay, let's push that out of the way. We now have that in our mind as we're evaluating these options. Let's talk about sharing while it's in progress, Rob.
Okay.
Pros and cons.
Okay. Well, let's see. If you're sharing it while it's in progress, you have a chance to receive acknowledgement sooner. Mm-hmm. That's probably a pro.
Odds are, even if you're lying low with the plans to release something, you want people to interact with the thing. So yes, getting some kind of ding, 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 thumbs up, good job today, mm-hmm. is a pro. I would also throw in the warning that, and this came from some other friends I was talking to about this, you go public with it, you just made a statement of intent to the world. And if you decide to abandon it partway, you better be okay with doing that in front of other people. And some people are. You know, I mean, it depends on your disposition. You know, I like to hide behind the words of, I believe it was attributed to Benjamin Franklin, maybe it was somebody else, but I reserve the right to change my mind at any given moment. Not to say that I am capricious, but, you know, I get to change my mind.
I call that you can't punish learning.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm totally writing that down.
Yeah, I mean, once you cross the threshold of there was a certain experience and a kind of thing that I wasn't aware of, and now I am, okay, well, yeah. Things might be different, and it's cool to act different if, you know, that works for what you want to do.
But here's another example of how, when the audience begins to interact with your stuff, you know, expectations get baked into it, whether you intended those expectations to be there or not, whether you set those expectations or whether those expectations are sort of kind of implicit in the sharing of the song. I've been on my Tumblr and all my other social things, I've been posting these little dumb sketches of Boulder and Fleet, Adventures for Hire, right? And I've been doing these as I've been working on the pitch that I want to start showing to my agent and publishers and so on. Well, as I came to the concluding, what I consider to be a pretty good draft of the pitch, sent it to my agent, wait to see what he has to say. There wasn't as much pressure on me to do any more sketches of Boulder and Fleet because a lot of those sketches were for the pitch. So I started sketching something else. Started sketching this thing that was like this teddy bear in a suit. And actually it was based on an idea that I came up with in 2004 called Dr. Bear, where it would be about a teddy bear who is like, it's like Trapper John MD or Quincy or like any of those like medical drama mysteries, but with stuffed animals.
Oh, right? My.
And yeah, so it'd be all these cute stuffed animals, and there's this bear who, you know, is like, oh, he's got to perform surgery on this hippo whose stuffing got ripped out, and like there's this big, you know, patting his head with the sponge and everything while he's sewing up the hippo. But then he also goes on like awesome rip-roaring Indiana Jones style adventures. He gets caught up in the mystery about how did the hippo get injured. Well, there's this bigger, more sinister story behind it that he gets caught into anyway. So I started sketching it just like, you know, I missed the, you know, doodling around with Dr. Bear. Well, some people started messaging me like, hey, are you giving up on Boulder and Fleet? Because now you're doing sketches of something else, you know? And I was like, dude, I'm just playing. I'm just playing around. This is just a diversion for me. The Boulder and Fleet pitch is in, you know, it's where it needs to be. And while I wait on that, I'm doing this. I'm just going to goof around a little bit. But see, there was already an expectation that, okay, this is all we're going to see from Jersey for a while, right? So the first thing I would say is, like, if you intend on sharing, is that even if you do it in a casual way, there's an implicit statement of, this is the thing. This is the thing to expect from me for the foreseeable future, right?
What I'm curious about is, so what's your expectation when you publish something? Do you expect to receive? Well, you or anyone like where we both can think about this question. Yeah. Do you expect to publish to get people to view a lot, but then not respond in any way? Right. In other words, that's a lot more traditional. That's like a very centralized publication industry approach where you reach sort of you're broadcasting. You're not really expecting the interaction. And in my experience, if you build or publish anything anywhere, it's going to lead to someone, anything ranging from someone liking it or commenting on it or saying something that you maybe didn't want to hear to you finding like your life partner. It's going to lead to something.
That's the guarantee we make on the show is yes, this is like making a webcomic is like Match.com.
Yes.
Or eHarmony. Find all those different degrees of compatibility. But no, you're right. I mean, like, I think this is one of those things where that thing I referred to at the beginning about how, you know, one of the things I like about teaching is it makes me think really hard about what I do is I had to think about what do I want when I post those dumb little sketches on Instagram and Tumblr and everything. What's the reaction I'm hoping for here? Because I've had a couple things get shared a lot on Tumblr, like a lot for me, like 700 times. That's a lot for me. That's not a lot for a lot of cartoonists, but it's a lot for me. What benefit did I derive out of that, right? Nothing. I mean, there's attribution on the thing, but I have yet to see any direct sales, anybody saying like, oh, Jersey Droz, thank God I found you at this convention. I want to buy all your stuff because of that drawing of a crayon unicorn that you did on Tumblr 2 years ago. Something getting passed around feels good, but you know, there's no direct benefit that I can detect out of something like that. And you get, there's benefits in the form of like people, you know, feeling like they're interacting with you was something that Eli Nyberger said on the Comics Are Great show, which, you know, I think there's some merit to is this idea that you want to give the impression of friendship with your audience, like a relationship. You want to create a relationship with your audience, some kind of we're in this together thing, even though we're not really friends, we're friendly, right? What do you say to that, Rob?
Yeah, I mean, let's see. It's, oh man. There's just too many points there. So you're like,
sorry.
No, it's exciting. It's so you did think about like what the reason that you're or what you're hoping to get out of this. And so what was it? Like I guess you don't have to share it, but I'm curious.
Oh, you mean like when I share the dumb sketches?
What was your decision? Like, yeah, so what did you want to get out of it?
Look at the thing I did. I made a dumb little sketch and I'm not attached to it today. The Boulder and Fleet ones, it's like, I got to do these for the pitch while I'm doing them. There's nothing hurts in sharing them and seeing if anybody responds to them. It was test case, right? I did one drawing of Boulder and Fleet having a picnic together, which got shared more than other things on Tumblr. And then I had images of Boulder and Fleet that got more thumbs ups on Instagram. So it becomes kind of like a test kitchen kind of thing. Like, what are the moments people are responding to out of context, right? But other than that, nothing, right? Fun.
But okay, that is interesting though. So you are getting, what are people responding to? And so that could be informing, not that you're, not the, not in the seeking of the pandering, but like, are you, are you know, to just playing to get a crowd because you know they're going to react because you're like, I love this, tis the city, whatever, you know, that kind of thing. they're providing you their time and attention, and their reaction is informative because you're like, oh, okay. This kind of, so think of, I know it's silly and it's an ancient example, but like the first, I would argue like the first four Metallica albums are a business plan being tested and refined.
Explain.
And well, there's a lot of, well, it's especially the numbers three through four or two through four, because the first one was, okay, yeah, we got your attention, we can rock or whatever. Then the next one is, well, we think this is going to be, you're going to enjoy this, the us rocking in this way a lot. And then they found, then different songs resonated a lot on, you know, on Ride the Lightning, and then moving on to Master of Puppets. There's a similar structure to the album, like literally the flow of like, this song is introduced by an acoustic mellow introduction, then it, you know, kicks into something intense and whatever. There's a similar in general to the topics, and like you look at the title song on the album is the second song and all that stuff. And they were playing with that. And I think they kind of tightened a pattern, whatever. And I would argue like that's probably because of reaction from the audience, and their success was increasing through that. And so it is kind of like, that's a valid interplay between you and your audience, that they can be helping you write your business plan because of what they're saying. We like what you have to say about that thing.
Yeah. Definite benefit of sharing, right? And there's other bits to it too. Like one of the things I played with is, you know, tagging, right? Mm. So I've got all these images of a bear and a bird. Let's see what happens if I share it with these words, and see what happens if I share it with these words, and see how people interact with it. So there's a lot of kind of fine tuning you get to do on the fly, in addition to the fun interactions that you get out of talking with people who say, hey, I like that bear you drew. And I go, thanks, I like drawing bears.
But that's a beautiful conversation.
You know, this is why I like working with kids, because that's the kind of conversations that I have with kids, and I feel like it's so much more honest and sincere than the ones I have with adults, because the kid isn't trying to outsmart me or outfox me. It's like, you know what? Skylanders are pretty cool. I'm like, yeah, they sure are.
Yeah.
Anyway, but you know, so you know, we got this idea of the statement of commitment and the beginnings of interactions and the opportunities to test. And then I realized that, especially when I was playing around with the Dr. Bear thing, which I openly said, I'm just playing here, I'm not doing anything serious. But the fact that I was sketching it like the Boulder and Fleet things was an implication of expect this next project. So then it got me wondering, should we be considering, if we're going to share online, is this thing worked out? Is the beginning, middle, and end worked out? Or are you going to share that? Are you going to be open about figuring this thing out in public, right? And that's more fodder for sharing, right? If you want to do that, if you're comfortable with that. But that's something where you got to have a little bit of self-knowledge. Or if you feel like, you know, what did Rob say? You can't punish learning. It could be something where you retract, right? You say like, oh, you know what? I'm not going to do that bit anymore because I didn't enjoy it, or I didn't get a reaction out of it, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that I wanted to throw on there is, I'm going to refer to Pixar's 22 Rules of Storytelling again. I don't know why everything is reminding me of that lately, because you know my position on lists. But Rule 14, why must you tell this story? What's the belief burning within you that your story feeds off of? That's the heart of it. Is that there? Or is this something where you're saying, well, you know, ninjas are really hot. If I take a ninja and I make it a pig, because Angry Birds is really hot, so I make a pig ninja and it kind of looks like Angry Birds, I got something there, right? Mm-hmm. There's a difference between knowing something has legs and doing something in a reaction to what audiences are responding to. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and especially if you care about the thing. If you inherently already really believe in pig ninjas, then...
That's one thing.
Yeah, that's different. You should just, yeah, pig ninja it up. I can't help but be reminded to my experience of going through producing Art Geek Zoo, knowing I had no idea what I was really doing. and discovering it along the way and saying, like, if I even care about continuing to do this, that's just part of what it is. And so for me, it was there's you have a chance when you share publicly. There's a thing that I think you mentioned, Jersey. I just want to re-emphasize a little bit an aspect of it, which is the conversation and the interactions and the distribution of it. You're not just making a thing. You're sharing a thing. And in the sharing a thing, that's another skill set that, whether it's a small thing, an incremental thing, or a giant thing, the sharing of a thing is a pretty handy skill set, no matter what. You don't have to have it as an artist. You can connect to ways of doing business that make sure that you're in a sort of behind the scenes role, and you don't have to worry about that. But if you're going to engage in any of these situations where, like, you're sharing with an audience or whatnot, you're going to be needing to probably get some practice at that, because it's a separate skill.
Can I ask for a little bit of elaboration on that, Rob? Like, what do you mean it's a separate skill? I mean, sharing, I just push a button and I wait for the people to hit the thumbs up thing. That's sharing.
Or then they share it and they comment on it. Or you publish it on a blog and you allow comments, and then they're commenting back at you. And so now it's a, your work isn't done. It's a, where do you draw the line and when do you expect the line to end and all that? If you're having a mismatch, you might get grumpy about that. Like, you might be like, hey guys, shut up about the thing I made 5 weeks ago. I'm really busy. You know? And that's informative. If you're like, gosh, I don't have the bandwidth to do the, you know, this kind of thing. Well, then shut off comments on your blog or whatever.
Yep.
And try to find a way, but you're still, you're finding the sort of some of the parameters and, like, you as a resource and your interests. I mean, maybe it's you dig the performance aspect of it. I ended up finding that I could drive way more traffic to the things I made the better and more fun I made the tweet or whatnot. It made a huge difference to how many people looked at the thing and then possibly, you know, commented on the thing.
I've been thinking about that a lot, Rob, about how I, in the past, gosh, this has been such an interesting, like, last 10 years, because, like, when I started, I was coming at it from the traditional comics publishing world of, I am the author, you are the audience, I'm here to entertain you, shut up, read the thing, buy my products. We are not to interact directly, right? And then I got into the whole thing, like, well, interacting, forming relationships, building community, awesome. But now I'm thinking about how, you know, most of the people who see my stuff probably don't know who I am or probably don't remember who I am. And I need to stop, or I need to bear that in mind when I'm constructing my posts, like on Google Plus or something. Because, like, most of the people I engage with on Google Plus, I don't know. It's not like Facebook where it's like, oh, all my friends are here. There's, like, it's a whole bunch of strangers there. And so when I say, like, hey, I did another drawing of a bear today, what does that mean to a stranger, right? I got to think about this thing as also being a platform where I'm beginning a conversation with strangers, right? Mm-hmm. And you don't just walk up to somebody and say, well, how do you think I felt about that? That's not your opening line in somebody, you know, somebody you just met today. And I need to think about when I'm making these posts, how can I phrase this? Like, every post becomes an opportunity to build a log line, right? For the story you're trying to tell that day.
And that could be really exciting if you're like, well, this is really interesting. I first, or even if at first it was annoying, because I've had that a lot where I'm like, I don't know if I want to learn this. I just want to make the thing. But then all of a sudden it has this, I don't know. For me, it's like if I get some foothold and I can start to puzzle out how it works and then feel like I'm building a skill, then I'm like, oh, neat, you know. And what you're describing is exactly the essence of what I was getting at, which is the sharing of a thing is a separate skill. Yeah. And your skills in creating the thing are also really important. And you may end up cross-pollinating or whatever. But then the distribution aspect of it, getting people aware, taking into account, where are they in the awareness of this thing I'm making? And is it a standalone? Are they meant to go back if they're there, if they're new, and go catch up? Or all that has to come into mind.
Right, right. And here's another way to think about it, another question to pose. And this is something that, another one of those things where upon thinking about it, I realized I haven't thought this through very carefully in the past. And I need to think more carefully about this. So again, thank you, Tyrell, for posing this question to us. Is what are you sharing, and how does that contribute to the overall culture surrounding the thing that you're making? So, okay, let's talk about the Boulder and Fleet pitch just for a second as a quick example. I've shared the pitch with a few trusted colleagues and friends to say, hey, could you give me some input on it? I want to get your reactions to it. And one of the things one of my friends said to me is that the text of the pitch should feel just as light and breezy as the art and narrative within the book feels. I should be able to read the prose and get the sense of the tone of the book. Don't just tell me what happens. Don't just tell me what motivations are, but give me a sense of the feeling from the text, right? In other words, he was describing the pitch as being one complete stylistic package representing the entire, like a movie trailer. A movie trailer should give you a sense of what the tone and what feelings, what emotions you're going to experience in watching that movie, right? See the Iron Man 3 trailer? Sure looks like it's going to be grim. Looks like it's going to be a very dark and scary superhero movie with some light moments and a few awesome moments, right? The pitch should be like that. So, okay. In other words, a culture surrounding the thing you're making, and that gets me wondering, should the things you share add up to that culture? Now, most of the time, I'm guessing it's going to come from, that culture is going to come out of a natural inclination of the artist, right?
Mm-hmm. It's part of their creative voice.
Yeah, part of their creative voice. But then just like we were talking about fine tuning our stuff by seeing what people react to between different tags and different images that we share, should we not also be thinking about what we share is contributing to that overall culture as well? So if I'm doing, say, Dr. Bear, this silly little stuffed animal hospital show comic, is the audience for that book going to necessarily care if I do a live stream of me drawing the 3-point perspective illustrations of the hospital? Right? That may be of interest to some people, but does it contribute to the overall narrative of the thrust of this project?
And therein lies, you probably don't just have one audience. That's another matter also, is that you may find a lot of connection and support from people who are on a similar mission as you, where there are different musicians in very different style bands, but they can share the experience of being musicians and maybe even one another's music appreciation. But when they're, you know, reaching out to their audiences, they're in different, you know, they're on different shelves, right?
Yeah.
So you may very likely run into, especially in the realm of comics, you may connect with other comic artists. There's a ton of that going on and people asking for it by having their social presences and all the different podcasts that exist. And yeah, there's a lot of community building and interaction things out there. So,
well, and speaking of interactions, this was a final note that I wrote down, is I remember when the community or relationship aspect of sharing finally kind of clicked for me was when a reader, while I was serializing one of my comics online, asked a really insightful and obvious question that I didn't address in the story. like I looked at my notes and I'm like, I looked at all my thumbnails. I'm like, I don't address that question. That's a good question. Time to write a new scene. And thank God this reader asked that question before I got to where the scene would have to go. Right. Like it wasn't like something I needed to put in the beginning. So, and
super cool.
And then I realized, oh, ding, ding, ding. This is another thing where you have a live laboratory to test out stuff. And like Krishna Sadasivam of PCweenies.com has said, like the webcomic is the first draft of his comic, right? So that's a huge benefit. But if I was somebody who of a different disposition, and this is something that, again, that self-honesty comes into it. If you're the kind of person who doesn't like that kind of input, you better shut comments off on your site or train yourself to not read your email, because you're going to get a lot of things like that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's I've run into this throughout my career in doing web related projects, and especially in the realm of business, who, you know, you can have businesses who maybe aren't used to interacting with their audience, and then they set up a web presence like back in the 90s. And that's shocking when they start all of a sudden realizing there's this pent up need to interact with them that they weren't set up to deal with. And when you're sharing what you made, you need to be prepared that it at least exists. I'm not saying you need to set up a PO box and set, you know, do all these extra things to over prepare. Just be aware that, well, that's a thing that naturally happens, and it's very human. Like if you make something that causes someone to react for whatever purpose, that's going to happen. I mean, and if it doesn't happen, that's actually worth thinking about too.
Well, yeah, and actually in one of the resources I've got for the on the ground section, there's a talk on that very topic for follow-up on that. I want to get to keeping it under wraps.
Cool.
Option two. So we explored sharing openly. What are the pros and cons of keeping something under wraps? One of the big cons is, you know, at least for guys like me, I become impatient with the stuff I'm sitting on. It's not fun to work under an NDA.
Oh my gosh. And especially are you talking about self NDA where you purposefully
both.
Yeah. Yeah. Either way has a similar result, where if you say I'm going to make my own project in secret, or I do this all the time. I'm working on tons of stuff I can't talk about.
Yeah.
Great. Which is an interesting thing to think about when you're assigning a value to your time and a rate. Because, you're trading away that. It's worth observing.
Yeah.
And NDAs, whether self-imposed or otherwise, they're
non-disclosure agreement. Actually, we should say.
Sorry about that.
No. I started it. I get really annoyed when people use acronyms on shows.
TLAs. Three-letter acronyms.
TLDR, you know what I mean? We're doing an inside thing, and other people don't know what we're talking about. Oh, you're dumb. Actually, I got a side note. So I go to coffee this morning every Thursday, and you can watch my Instagram feed to see my Thursday sketches. Every Thursday, I go to this coffee shop.
I love it.
Bruce Roast, and I've got a green jacket, and the case for my tablet is green, and they kind of match. And yes, that was kind of intentional because I like the color green a lot. Look at the walls behind me. Look at the bar underneath my face. Anyway, love the color green. Green's the color of money. But anyway, so I show up and like somebody makes a comment. One of the guys at the coffee shop's like, wow, I don't see many people, like many men accessorizing the way you do, Jersey. And I made a joke, you know, ha, ha, ha. I'm laughing it off. And I was like, it's a Green Ranger thing. I love Power Rangers. And Eli was there, and he's like, I know the real reason behind this. It's the Wizard of Speed and Time, which we're going to talk about in a little bit, because the Wizard of Speed and Time had a green jacket and green shoes and like that. Yeah, and that actually was part of it, and it was a good observation by Eli. And he's like, why don't you tell people that? And I said, because not many people have heard of this movie, and I don't want to, you know, have to say, like, it's this weird cult film and blah, blah, blah. And then they said, But then you get to be the guy who says, oh, you wouldn't have heard of it. It's a cult film that only like really privileged people like me. And then
you have this awesome weapon you're not using.
Right. One of the guys say that. And then Eli, bless his heart, says, yeah, but Jersey's too earnest to do something like that. He would try to sell them on what an awesome movie this is and weird about it even more. I'm like, yes, that's exactly why I can't talk about it. I try to use, you know, cultural symbols that people are more broadly aware of because, yeah, if you haven't seen Wizard of Speed in Time, it's awesome. Anyway, how did I get on that?
Exploring the color green and your, the Thursdays.
No, it's because I'm self-involved.
Keeping a number under wraps.
Artificial scarcity. Let's talk about artificial scarcity.
Yep.
Which this term gets a kind of a bad rap from people sometimes, especially when you start talking to the sharing advocates. It's like, oh, you're making artificial scarcity in order to replicate old economies and old business models. But artificial scarcity can sometimes be based on real scarcity, right?
Yeah. Like your time you can stay awake and be effective and all that. And sustain a healthy existence. I mean, if you, let's see, if you are into this to have, well, one of the reasons why, so we kind of a little bit poo-pooed NDAs somewhat. I mean, and I probably had that tone like, cause it's a mixed bag. I mean, but part of why they exist is super legitimate because some businesses cheat. They do. They steal ideas like little gremlins, like, and they'll take it and then go, you know, supply with, you know, their set up with cheaper resources and whatever, and then try to beat other businesses to market.
Did you see that thing that Ryan Estrada linked to today on Twitter where somebody took, copied somebody else's Kickstarter campaign, copied all information and did it as an Indiegogo campaign and presented themselves as the same people?
Oh,
dirty, wow. Huh? Dirty pool. I guess super they didn't, dirty. They got taken down. They got caught.
Yeah.
And in the article that Ryan linked to, which I'll find for the show notes, it came out of the artists, or the creators of the Kickstarter campaign, keeping a Google alert open for their names and found out about it that way. So a little bit of narcissism does pay off, right? Being a little like, what's the internet saying about me today can be also not just self-gratification, but can also be policing things for yourself.
Yeah, they call that social listening.
So that's good. Social listening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's, I mean, it's exactly, the. I don't know what to say. Narcissism, it's a desire to not have a... it's tough. I mean, so I've designed and built systems for many years, and some of them were in the financial industry, and that probably helped get me, you know, encourage me toward a very paranoid path when I think about design and whatnot, because you build things for a certain reason and you're doing things for a certain reason, and help someone else, the situation that you're building it in and anyone else that can be aware of or participate, they don't have to share your motivation. And that's where stuff can happen. That's where things can get hacked. And that's where, you know, it's like, I didn't expect anyone to be mean, you know? Yeah. Crazy thing. Sometimes it, you know, and that's one way to put it is you're not sharing the same motivation.
Right.
And, I think some of that drives the real aspect of the scarcity. And I think we can way over engineer when we're doing independent works, especially when we're practicing, we can be overly severe and acting like I've been this guy. That's why I'm describing this. I'm setting up a long-term serious business. I'm super dedicated to this. And everyone that gets involved is signing an NDA. I've been that guy. And I'm sorry for that. I've learned. But because it seems like it's the right model in some ways, and sometimes it is, but it's not always, right? So anyway, that gets to the, it depends. One reason to keep things under wraps is just because your time is scarce and you don't have the time to have all the conversations.
Yep.
That may or may not happen, but.
Artificial scarcity or scarcity of any kind drives up demand as well, right? If it becomes, if we make it into a limited resource, I only can do this X amount of times a week, or I'm only going to engage with you in this very, very limited fashion. I'm going to only give out these teaser images, if anything at all, or making it into something where the book is only going to be available through this Kickstarter campaign, and then it vanishes. Then it's gone forever. The Disney Vault. Dave Roman is in the is actually watching live, and I know he's probably screaming that at me right now. the Disney Vault, that is the perfect example of artificial scarcity. And they do this, like, Pinocchio's out again for a limited time, and after that, it's going into the vault forever. And they show this big vault door closing with the Mickey Mouse ears on it. It's like, no, don't take it away from me. I have to go to the store and get another copy of Pinocchio, right? It works. So people respond to that stuff. And is it manipulation? Sure. But isn't, as Rob has pointed out many times in the show, art is manipulation. We want to manipulate people's feelings. We want them to react to something. We're constructing ideas to get people to react to them. That is, by definition, manipulation. So I'm trying not to be too judgmental about it.
Yeah, and there's, because, well, let's see, and if you know that what's interesting, what you're describing is actually an interesting hybrid, because you're talking about not a hermetically sealed wall between your project and the universe. You're saying, well, there's little things that escape. And so you're doing experimental demand generation awareness things. You're wanting to grow awareness so that as you progress, you will have someone that wants to buy the thing you're making. But you don't want to reveal too much. That's an interesting actual compromise. I think you're already starting to describe that is not perfectly, you know, working in complete isolation, nor is it saying, hey, participate as I incrementally do the thing.
Well, and that's the important thing to spell out here, is that this is a spectrum. You get to figure out where you fall on that. And that's one of the reasons that I get kind of prickly when people start talking about, like, operating too much from their bias, saying, look what I did, you should, now you can do it. If I can do it, you can do it, which comes from a good place. But prescribing your life pattern on somebody else is fraught with danger, in my opinion.
Absolutely.
Which brings up the question, how scarce do you want to make it? And I remember having a conversation, this was about, I want to say almost 10 years ago, as I was beginning to do webcomics, and, you know, I was talking with some friends from the publishing world, and who were familiar with my work up to that point, the stuff I was doing at Antarctic Press and so on. And they're like, wait a minute, you're just giving the comic away online? Why? And I was like, because I want to build an audience, and nobody's heard of this story, so I want to build an audience for it. And they said, well, you know what I would do? I would give away everything except the last 10 pages. And then I'd put up a JPEG that says, ha ha, suckers, you don't get to see how it ends until you buy the book. And I was like, oh, that's awful. Why would you do that to people? But, you know, it's like, you think about the book being the ultimate scarcity. If you say, I'm not sharing any of this online, the only way to get it is to get it as a book. Right? There's the ultimate DRM. Or you can go with other different levels of DRM, right? Or all the way down to like what Ryan Estrada does, where it's like, here it is, you can get it for free, or you can pay whatever you think it's worth. There's a lot of choices in there.
The ultimate DRM is don't be digital.
Yeah.
Be physical. Yeah. I'm just trying to reinterpret what you said.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just saying a book, and a book can mean anything nowadays. But yeah, I mean,
No. It's,
make it atomic. It has to be made of atoms. That's the ultimate DRM.
Yeah.
Digital rights management, by the way, copy protection.
Yeah. Oh, another TLA. it's, and as, some of that you can figure out with your audience as you interact, where, it's a little bit getting back to the book, To Sell as Human, is that if you are interacting with your audience, you're going to understand what kind of, what about the thing you're making is what they're willing to pay you, because it's so wild how this works, but it's different for every darn business. Where some people can get paid for a raw material, and or some people can get paid for a finished good that's barely finished, or Some people, it's just like, there's so many ways to engage in the trade, and like, well, and it's just up to you and your audience, really. And so how do you know that unless you do some kind of experimental, well, you know, maybe the experiment isn't where you're communicating and actually asking them, could be, but maybe it's just you do an initial low risk production of it. Maybe you produce the prototype. A lot of times businesses will find a way to do a prototype then to see if it has legs, which is actually a common way people tackle Kickstarter now.
Yeah.
Because they're like, yeah, I got the skill to do it. Here's the thing. Look at it go, whatever. And how about some more money? We do even more. Yay. And, that's a thing. That's up to you and your audience. And that's an arrangement that you get to make. As far as the, you know, what level of DRM, what level of scarcity. And I'm not trying to just, you know, dodge. It's like they have to keep it in wraps.
It depends. No, but you're right. I don't think either of us are saying it depends. I think what we're just saying is see this spectrum of choices, evaluate that spectrum of choices. We can't tell you what, because we've played with all of them. Dave Roman is actually typing in the YouTube comments. He says, this is going back to our initial point about sharing openly, is about making a commitment to things publicly or implicitly even. I usually keep things under wraps because I've had too many projects that end up sizzling out for whatever reason. This does happen. And I hate when people ask when something is coming out and I have no answer. Ugh, that's the worst. That's the worst.
I'm working on a video game. Haven't talked much about it.
Yep.
Because, oh boy, am I familiar with discovering complexity as a project is underway. And I've got the practice and discipline to know I will manage that complexity over time. But like, there's aspects of what my time that I'm investing is very thin on it. So I can't just crank up the amount of time I put in on it without, you know, causing other negative things, you know, in my life. So I can't really manage that risk other than just keep at it. Mm-hmm. Solve them when they come up, rate them, you know, rank them in priority and move on.
And what Dave's describing is such a hard thing to navigate, because when somebody's asking about something that didn't come out, it's coming out of a place where they want to see it. They're not nagging you. Mm-hmm. They're like, hey, that thing that you did that was so delightful that I got a few pages of, or what's going on with that? Is it ever going to come out? Please tell me it's coming out. Oh, I don't have an answer for that because it's tied up with these other copyright holders, or it's tied up with a publisher, it's tied up with whatever. Complications and complexity arise from making things. So yeah, mm-hmm. There's a very good reason to keep things under wraps, is you're opening yourself up to, I don't want to say feeling publicly, but things can fizzle out. And then, you know, if you don't have... It's tough to manage the customer service that comes in when people say, this thing that delighted me no longer is happening. What's going on with it? Right.
And that's one of the strengths of working mostly isolated and not sharing that much. The lying low is, well, you're not as much of a target for as much communication. So,
Courtney Hans in the YouTube comments says, well, we're getting a lot of comments tonight. Good. This is a topic that people care about. Sometimes I feel like if I start sharing something before I'm uber passionate about it, if I start sharing before then, it'll usually fizzle out and I'm onto the next thing that walks into view. This kind of reminds me of this notion of don't tell your friend, or don't tell too many people the story that you're working on before you've actually done it, because then the job of telling it is over and you kind of...
Well, yeah, you're looking at your own motivations and what is the reason you're producing this as an artist? And if you feel like you've expressed it and you've been heard, where, maybe this is, you know, we should start moving out to the on the ground on this.
Oh, yeah, yes, you are right. Cause we have been going on for over an hour now. So, well, you know what? I want to do something that's a little bit more cheerful for hitting the ground, because
cool.
It was so grim when we started out. as we carefully chewed and chewed, put it in one stomach, spat it back up, chewed and chewed, put it in our fourth stomach, spat it back up. Okay, now let's actually talk about
it. Aren't those cows for that gross digestion pattern?
My name is Jersey. Ba-dun-dun. So we've got resources to, you know, like things to read, contemplate, and help navigate these questions.
And also, I want to cover Courtney's question in this area as well.
Oh,
okay. as we segue into it, it's the knowing what you're getting out of a project and your creative habits as you start to map out. You're like a really darn important resource in your creative business that you really have to know what makes you tick and why you make these things. If you wanted, you know, I would argue if you want to do it as a business, because then you get to be, you can manage those risks when they come up, when you don't feel like producing, when when you want to drop a project, but you have a certain commitment, and then that would lead to good cash flow and all that kind of stuff. You find out how to manage yourself. And I think that's super insightful, honestly, to say that, to notice like, well, sometimes I'm not, you know, that passion, it's got to cross a certain endurance of what is part of what I'm hearing there. Right.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's like, okay, this one's sticking around. Yep. And one of my tactics on that is, I don't know why I do this, but well, partially it's this. When I start a video game project, I just start two video game projects. And one of them lives and the other one dies. And it's not like a weird, as I guess I'm my own weird game show host and contestant when I do that. Anyway, because I noticed like which one is coming together conceptually and is like it's, and I'm proving out like the technologies I'm using to assemble it and all that, and how feasible is it? I'm like, all right, cool. This one's really feasible. Totally tabling that other one. So it's not dead, but
it's a great way of looking at it. You know, when I was doing the Boulder and Fleet pitch, I went through three very different drafts. Mm. And if I thought about taking two drafts at once, right? Here's an outline, here's an outline. Let's start developing each one independently and see what happens. Because when I got to that second draft and it was crap, and it really was, there was that demoralization of, oh, I failed. I've finally come up against the challenge I can't beat, and I get my final confirmation I'm no good. And then you got to spin yourself back up with a music montage of lifting weights and washing cars to be able to do the next draft, right?
Yeah.
But if I had one, if you have the two, then it's like, oh, this one sucks, but that makes this one look that much better. You know, I have some evidence that I'm not a complete hack right here.
Well, and you get to borrow from one another where, yeah, I mean, it's not like you're doing, you know what? I'm inventing a new helicopter and a new breed of corn and a comic. There's a ton of reuse where you're like, oh, these two characters, that's some good energy. But boy, the rest of it, I don't know how I can explain that. Well, then I can transplant it.
That's good.
So maybe it's a little, yeah, Island of Dr. Moreau. Anyway, I've never even seen that movie. Surprise.
But I also want to throw this into the on the ground section too, is when do I ship, right? This is a question we're trying to address here, is when right. is the thing ready to ship? Now, I'm going to invoke the name of Seth Godin. He polarizes people sometimes, but sometimes he says smart stuff. He was on Blogcast FM podcast, I guess, and it's at blogcastfm.com, but I'll link to it in the show notes. And it's typical Seth Godin stuff, but about three quarters into the interview, by the way, Seth Godin, motivational speaker, new media guy, you know, self-publishing, The Purple Cow, his other big one, the shifting.
Oh, the dip, press the button or something? Or
yeah. But about three quarters of the way in the interview, he addresses his one sentence answer to when to ship. And I thought this was really interesting. He says, there's a gulf between when it's good enough for the market and when you're not afraid of it anymore. And he said the problem that he sees is too many people wait for the latter instead of acting on the former. And I, wherever you fall on that spectrum of keeping it under wraps or sharing openly, I think it's a worthy question to ask yourself is, are you refraining out of a sense of feeling like it's not ready, being afraid of it, of committing to it, right? Either option requires a certain amount of courage, I think.
And I think when you notice you're doing something, like you detecting that resistance is really huge. And then starting to say, well, why am I resisting it? Because you can't, well, I would say, no, you really can't bring risk down to zero. So where is the risk? When's it tolerable enough? So why are you resisting it? If you're like, you know what? The cover isn't strong enough. All right, fine. I've said it. The cover isn't strong enough. I got to fix it. And okay, what about it? What do you need? You know, or are you just kind of, you know, having playtime with your creative demons? Yeah. So
I'm not funny. I don't want to share this stuff because I'm not funny and people are going to find that out. Okay. So you're not funny. What are you then?
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. I'm kind of funny, whatever. And
or maybe that's not your thing. Maybe my thing is this instead.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly. I say stuff that people react to, like Seth Godin.
Yeah. Okay. So
no, I'm not saying that me, I'm just whatever. That's our hypothetical. I don't know who we were role playing.
You were being the metaphorical, cartoonist or creator that we're addressing
through this. Cool.
All right. What other marketing the comic either way resources did we want to throw in here? The more and more I thought about it, the more I thought about you know, keeping it under wraps leads to the opportunity to create a big spectacle event around the thing's ultimate release, whether it's released as a digital item or as an atomic item. And I kept coming back to Kickstarter. Like, Kickstarter is probably the most interesting place to look for how people are managing that. Kind of like, here's the scarce thing that you can only get for this limited time, right?
Well, and it's also this thing that's really tough to picture, but like, growing an audience leads to, I don't know, difficult to understand numbers because there's just a lot of people out there. And you know, you go from, and you go from a small amount of people becoming aware of your thing. Did I oversimplify something humorously?
Yeah. No, just sometimes you're such a Midwesterner, and I, as a fellow Midwesterner, find it absolutely charming.
Thank you.
There's a lot of people out there, son.
That's cool. And you're right. I can laugh at that to myself too, but you know, and it is, and like we don't naturally think of big numbers. It's just not intuitive. Because even look at Kickstarter, and I wish I had an example offhand, but I know that there's projects that gained essentially their initial core fans. And that helped launch the product, much like the initial audience for a band helps launch the band. Or initial, let's think of comics that went from, the Charles Christopher, isn't that a print series now?
Oh, the Abominable Charles Amazing. Christopher?
Abominable, there we go. Yeah. I mean, but like you get comics that like have an initial audience that helps propel them to then a greater audience, not greater as in, oh, it's all better because it's bigger, but it's, you know, it's a larger audience that this initial, group is an amazing, important, part of the evolution of that business because they're able to help increase the awareness of that business because of they demonstrate that whatever they're doing, it's good, it's safe, it's awesome, we believe in it. And other people hear that and they're willing to the group helps it expand. And so sometimes it's a matter of like that perfect unawareness. That's where that can be an enemy, right? Where having a few people aware can help you create more people aware. I don't know if I'd summarize that.
Yeah, well, I mean, what you're pointing at is how this is one of the things that I don't feel like I could wrap my brain around is like the whole keeping it under wraps thing. If you don't have an audience yet, Like if you are, you know, you have no widely received credits beforehand. Like, this is the reason I took the front as a webcomic. Why I did a webcomic in 2003 was because up to that point I had published work, but I was not doing anything that a lot of people were aware of. So if I want to do this big graphic novel project, I have to build an audience first. And the best way I can think of to do it right now is to release it as a webcomic, right? Mm-hmm. But let's say, even if, let's take that out, take the webcomic out of it. How do you get an audience for a thing that does that when you don't have a network or a you know, a group of friends to help you spread the word? If you're coming into this thing blind, I just signed up for a Twitter account today. Time to start following some people. You know, I mean, what do you got to share something, right? You have to engage mm-hmm. somehow. How do you do it?
That would probably depend on your project. Let's see. How do you do it?
Well,
Probably venues. I think depending on what you're building. So, there are groups of people hunting for you. So go where they hunt. So in other words, like indie game blogs or whatnot, they want to see what, if you're producing artifacts that they care about, right? So if you're a comic artist producing, sweet bear, Dr. Bear sketches, and they have a blog where they talk about like new stuff in development, or whatever, then there may be a good, group for that. But maybe other groups are like, you know what? We only care about mini comics. Or what? So if you have the artifact that fits that group, then that's another good indicator too. So people are looking for you because people want that kind of, you know, they want cool creative stuff.
You think people are looking for Dr. Bear, Rob? That makes me feel better.
Holy crap, yes.
Okay, well, I got some other resources to point people at. So, like, right, going sweet. Back to this Kickstarter thing, Jason Brubaker of the Making Comics podcast, another great show on, process and interviews with creators on the way they do things. I'll put a link in the show notes, but he did, like, and it's kind of an older post. I guess it goes back to 2010, but he started a series of notes on, like, what made his Kickstarter successful and advice to people. Like, again, people speak from biases. Read it, compare it to what you know to be true, and if things don't meet, then that's that. I'm not saying go use this resource and you'll walk forth and conquer. Also, Spike Trotman of Templar, Arizona. She was on Comics Are Great recently talking about Kickstarter quite a bit, and Laura Uy from Poltergeist was on there as well. They both led successful Kickstarters and had a lot of great insights on what they think made their things work in the first place. And then Ryan Estrada. We can't do a Lean Into Art without talking about Ryan Estrada. He was on episode 17, an old episode, where he said that quintessential statement that I think is so I'm still chewing on it, is marketing is just talking to dudes. And he talks a lot about relationship building and being helpful to people. So this goes beyond like, okay, I don't have a webcomic. What can I do? You can be helpful to people. You can be friendly and helpful, and people will think of you as a trusted resource. So when you say, here's my thing, they'll say, oh, well, he's a great guy. Of course, I'm going to check it out, kind of thing.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that really helps if you're your own brand mascot in that situation.
Yeah. Right? I mean, one could argue that that's kind of what we're doing right here, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, making yourselves available to people to respond to them and try to be helpful to them. And then when I go, hey, guess what? I've got a thing coming out that's really important to me. Hopefully some of them will care. That's not.
Yeah.
That's
you
not
mean the, no one, no disembodied voice in a conference box or who is pays us and gives us orders and instructions. We just,
what are you talking about? Orson's right behind me.
Yeah. Orson or yeah. I actually was likening us to Charlie's Angels in that example, but we're doing this to demonstrate what we'd like to do to engage in trade.
Yeah, and then as another example from my own life, not to say do what I do, but as a way to think about this is, I do a silly little show, and Dave Roman is in the chat, and he's been on the show a lot, the Saturday Supercast, where I talk about with friends who love this stuff as much as I do. We talk about 80s cartoons, Saturday morning cartoons, picking them apart, deconstruct them, critiquing them. Why? Well, one, because I get a benefit out of thinking really hard about something that I love and taking those insights and takeaways and resources back into my own personal work. But two, somebody's going to say, oh, gee, there's a two-part episode on He-Man. I love He-Man. Wow, that jersey, he really loves He-Man. I should look at his work, because if he loves He-Man as much as I love He-Man, there's probably something in there that I will like as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's not the primary motivation, but that's a secondary or tertiary or helpful, you know, thing to consider when you're thinking about, well, how do I engage? How do I share? How do I build an audience around my thing if I don't want to give any of the ideas away? So,
exactly. You're growing those connections. And by the way, I mean, the other awesome podcast you and Dave Roman do is Kids Comics Revolution.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's another one where we interview people who make kids comics. And librarians and all sorts mm-hmm. of people. That's a good show, if I do say so myself. I get to say that because Dave makes it great. I just kind of go along for the ride and go, sure, Dave, I like that idea. but yeah, so there's a lot of different shows out there to check out. Also, one of the ones I learned about through doing the Kids Comics Revolution show is the Funding the Dream podcast, which is a Kickstarter show about funding gaming projects.
Oh, funny.
Which is kind of hit or miss. Some of them are kind of like, oh, this one's dry. And sometimes it's like, oh, this has nothing to do with what I do. But for the most part, they're pretty good interviews with different people in the gaming industry talking about different methods and different strategies and different ways they've used Kickstarter, which I would suggest take out the word Kickstarter. Just say business model, business plan, right?
Dude, that's exactly what this episode is about. I mean, we are talking about the business of art throughout this whole episode as far as what you're doing. And how are you engaging in trade with it? And the way in which you construct that's your business model.
Yeah. Dave's asking an interesting question in the chat. Which would get you more attention? You debut at a comic convention with a mini comic or a 1,000-page graphic novel?
Right. Are you throwing them?
What's on the cover, you know?
Yeah, exactly. No, it's what would get you more attention?
I could tell you from personal experience. It depends on the show. It depends on a lot of things. But I went to SPX last year, the Small Press Expo, spexpo.com, with the front, this big, thick graphic novel. It took a whole bunch of years for me to make, and I poured all my blood, sweat, and tears into it. And then I went with, and I don't have a copy here, which I did, little copy of Cat and Cat, which Rob has. There we go. Here, hold it up again. I'll put the camera on you. Yeah, see? And guess what? Captain Cat, this dumb little mini comic with a catchy idea. You can take it down now, Rob. Thank you. With a catchy title and an image of a cat in people clothes, I sold more of that than I did anything else. Well, there's different factors to consider. It was a $3 thing versus a $12 thing. Okay, well, we got that. But then also, here's this thing with a whole mess of concepts. Here's 14 characters on a cover. What's the central idea of this book? I can't tell. Looks like people running at each other. Might be something to do with action and adventure. But in any case, right, that's a thing to consider as well. It's like, whoa, mini comic or a 1,000-page graphic novel?
Then what I'm going to say is the one that is designed to convey its aboutness in a resonant way will win. If as far as getting you more attention, if that's the goal, that means that it doesn't matter if it costs you less than, you know, less than 50 cents to make and you handmade it. If you have this, the right imagery, the right words on the cover and, somehow presented in a way where it's able to be observed. And, that's going to connect more, and that would get you more attention. Because inherently. So think about the conversion from attention, interest, decision, and action. So now you have more people, you know, you're getting attention, they're having their interest, and now other humans are seeing them physically because it's in a convention, mm-hmm. giving the attention, and then people giving attention gets attention, and they tell their friends, and so on and so on.
Yeah. We have a whole bit here on products, the difference between products and services, Rob. Do you want to save that for another one? Because we got to get
to Yeah, I think we need to save a lot. Yeah, I don't even know. Like, what do you think, Jersey? Totally on the spot here. Should we save the quest too for next time?
You know what? Lucas is actually stayed up. It's almost 5 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, you know what? Duh. That's so awesome. Lucas is here. We can't do that to Lucas.
We can't do that to him. We cannot say like, oh, good. Thanks for staying up all night, Lucas. We'll do it next time. Bye. That's not
cool. No, yeah, sorry for even considering it, Lucas.
We've got a whole section here on, and this could be a whole episode in and of itself. And I think it has, the legs to do it.
Yeah. Let's do it.
Looking at this very same question through the notion of when you're engaging with an audience, are you creating a service or a product or some kind of weird amalgamation of both?
Mm-hmm.
So, with that, I think it's time that I play the Quest music. Fully energized, ready to talk quests, an A-team of our own. And boy, oh boy, the thing about these quests is I always wind up making something that I'm kind of, I wonder if I made an ugly baby when I look at what I made.
What? No way.
I always look at it and I go, like, what is this? What came out of my brain from thinking about this weird thing? But I don't want to start with mine. I want to start with Lucas Haig.
Okay.
Haig from let's see if I can pull up his blog post on it, because he hacked the game. While I pull it up, you explain what the quest was.
Yeah, okay. And by the way, Lucas's URL is theinkbot.tumblr.com. So the essence of this quest is that you're in the position to recruit a team of characters from any story in any genre in any medium. And then you pick a reason you're bringing those characters together, which is a big problem to solve. And there's a variety of them. And I'm not going to go through the whole detail of the post, but it could have been anything from like alien invasion to like international mystery to pulling off a big heist. There's a whole bunch of scenarios. So you pick a scenario, recruit a team, and then share a few observations about that. Like, why do you think, you know, they would work well together, or what would be the outcome? You know, like, would they succeed or fail? And that kind of thought about your team. And there you go. And well, if you want to go even further, then of course you are welcome to draw your team, and that's the way to do it. So, yeah.
Okay.
That's the gist of this quest. I mean, so it's all about getting you to think about bringing together characters that you've resonated with, and you end up facing the reasons that you resonated with them, and then how they would possibly work together, which I ran into a bunch of interesting things there as well. Well,
let's start with Lucas's, then I want to talk about yours a little bit, because you put together a pretty weird team too. But Lucas basically used this as a springboard to do a premise for a story.
I love that.
And he says like, oh, Rob, I hope you don't mind if I keep this idea and try to make it into an actual thing now.
No, I'm terribly disappointed.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, no. What a shame if you actually got some extra use out of this thing.
No, that rocks. I mean, yeah, exactly. It's because whether... explicitly or implicitly, you're creating a story dynamic that you can totally reuse. In Lucas's case, he's doing a lot of awesome invention here.
Well, yeah, I want to read about some of these characters while I scroll through them. It's like he's got Magenta Ray, a superhero known and named for his preference for the color magenta. Awesome. Uses a power suit to give him access to various superpowers such as flight, super strength, and energy projection, to name a few. Vlakov the Blue, which I don't know how well that's showing up. Maybe I should zoom in. There we go. A powerful archmage who originally focused on ice-based spells and magic, hence the name. And he's got a C, so this is the B team. Then there's a C team. There's Deer D-I-R. Dampier Trickster, traveling the multiverse, makes his coin by taking on various mercenary jobs as well as more underhanded con schemes. Chuck Jones, a big game monster hunter from Earth, uses a variety of high-tech gadgets in combination with an assortment of firearms as well as wit to accomplish his goals. The goals usually being kill the big stompy thing who's destroying everything. Yojimbo, this is the most developed one, at least visually. A wandering poet and swordsman combines kabuki-style dance with swordsmanship to catch his opponents off guards. He has a crystal bell he rings before a fight begins. He also learned to use it as a form of echolocation device. That's kind of cool. And so then he goes into like how the basically a pitch for the story, a brief little outline of what the story could be. And this goes back to that sharing idea. He just shared all this stuff openly, and now we get to see if he gets to execute on it, right?
Exactly. And what's super fun is so whenever you've had your initial outline for a story, I mean, do you always stick to it perfectly? Or do you discover nuances as you write?
Hopefully I discover nuances.
Yeah. I mean, so what's cool is like it seems like he revealed it, but I would bet there's going to be super awesome new things that everyone's going to discover as it plays out. Mm-hmm. If this does become a story that Lucas puts forth, which is so funny that it relates to our big topic, how he did share this publicly, but then it's not the story yet. So,
right,
it'd be interesting to watch that transpire. So,
yeah, and I would say to anybody listening who, like, let's say you're one of the people who have listened to us talk about the quest, said that sounds interesting, but I don't have time or I don't want to share something that you guys would talk about on the show. Okay, fine. Respond to Lucas. Go to theinkbot.tumblr.com and, you know, respond with a comment. You don't have to make anything, but you can engage with it and say what you like or what you are confused about or what you, what parts of the design are responding to or you're responding to or which ones you think are kind of an odd fit.
Yeah. Or the excitement, right? Like, oh my gosh, what are you curious about learning about based on right. Lucas's pitch?
Yep. I think that would be cool. So that's at theinkbot.tumblr.com. We'll link to it in the show notes. It's also on the Lean Into Art Tumblr. That's the other thing. You participate in the quests, you get reblogged on the Lean Into Art Tumblr. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about yours. Let's talk about your weird grouping of people. Toru Honda.
So Toru Honda, Gore Brunelli, and Piccolo from Dragon Ball Z. Which, inherently, I was joking on the prior episode, like who would be my team? And it's actually kind of where I started, which is, so Goku from Dragon Ball Z, Buffy Summers from Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and, Rick Hunter from Robotech, and, just going through this laundry list of favorite characters, protagonists from different, different series. And, as it turned out that as I started to pair the primary protagonist characters together, I didn't feel like a lot of neat energy between the characters. And I was debating as far as like how they would end up together and crossing worlds and all that stuff. And then I started exploring the different characters in those worlds. And then also jumping to different stories that I'm also super excited about, but not just, sticking to like, oh, these are the top five favorite things I've ever, ever watched or read or what have you. And then it ended up taking an interesting life. And I've got this weird team with, we're essentially, I don't know. In a nutshell, Gore Brunelli is like this, he's also from the story that I referred to last episode, The Commonwealth Saga by Peter F. Hamilton. Wonderful series of books, which it's just two books, but they're super duper thick. And awesome audiobooks, by the way. This Gore guy, he's essentially, what Iron Man would be in like 1,000 years or so, or a few hundred years into the future. And but except he uses all his super brain, supercomputing capabilities to be making billions of business decisions a second and you know, running a giant empire. Except when his family's in danger, and then he's like super is entertaining to read about his capabilities. Piccolo, I think seeing in the first first story arc of Dragon Ball Z, Piccolo's story is super awesome. It's one of the standout things, and seeing him turn from bad to good, and then he remains cool throughout the series. And I thought, well, this is someone who's not like the foregone conclusion, the guaranteed win hero, as you know, Piccolo is. He's in a lot of tough situations. He's pretty capable, but thrown into an alien invasion, he's not just guaranteed, you know, the guy that's going to take care of it for everybody. He's going to have to combine collaborating and being super awesome, capable, and achieve new levels of awesome as he goes along. Actually one thing that got me really interested was, all right, I don't want everyone to be this crazy super physical hero. What if one of these characters was about about essentially caring and empathy and awareness, like even in the midst of like some difficult alien invasion, extinction level event possibility, like what would be the super caring and thoughtful character that would have a different angle on that whole situation? And one of my favorites with that description is Toru Honda from Fruits Basket. And I just pictured her being a little bit older than when she was in Fruits Basket, but essentially studying at this sort of this academic alien culture school lab thing, some very remote planet, and then making some discoveries. Alien invasion starts there, and everything goes down. So and the rest of it's in the post. But then Toru actually probably, I don't know, like she might actually end up getting some kind of temporary superpowers because of like connecting with an alien or something. So either she would have like an alien mind link kind of thing, and that can go both it would have negative effects as well. So you would see Toru dealing with being betrayed and that kind of stuff, not to just be mean to Toru, but like she would be definitely a vehicle for people to be very concerned for her vulnerability. Yet she's always a character who, even though she's very vulnerable, she's incredibly emotionally strong. So anyway, it'd be interesting to see her deal with that.
Cool. So you were actually thinking pretty hard about the character dynamics as you were putting the team together.
Yeah. That's where I ended up playing around. And
that is not something that I did.
I am super curious, man. Like I looked at your post image, and it I thought it was awesome just from the three characters you picked. But then
I just came at it thematically with mine, and I just said, because what I thought, so if folks actually go ahead and subscribe to the mailing list and listen to the Extra Lean show. Oh, you're doing screen share, Rob?
Yeah, I'll do screen share. You
shut mine off? All right.
Fucking head.
Yeah, because my laptop's starting to spin up its fan a little bit. It's like, oh, you're making me work too hard. So anyway, let me get the camera off of me and put it back on the, there we go. So, anybody who listens to the Extra Lean, especially the one that we're going to post next, I think we talk about, I test ran this quest in my classroom, and I had some observations based on what the kids responded to and what they did. And one of the things that the kids had the most fun with was choosing between the different scenarios that you put forth. And so I was like, okay, well, let's not go for the obvious scenario. Let's not go for the alien invasion one, because that's the one I would probably most want to do. Let's pick a different one that I wouldn't pick normally. And so I came up with like a list of like, okay, here's like the bottom two, the ones I'd least want to do. And so I picked one of those, which was training a plucky young youth. And so that raised the next question. Well, what would a plucky youth need to know? What was the most important thing to teach this person? I thought, well, that success is built on a mountain of failures. Ah, there's my insight. Okay, I'm going to build a team of people who fail a lot, but we love them for failing. And so I thought my first pick was Skybite from Transformers: Robots in Disguise. And as I put in the post, I'll just sum it up quick. Neil Kaplan once described him as a Shakespearean actor who's forced to play second banana in everything. And so it's watching somebody with a lot of outward dignity getting humiliated, but he keeps trying. And that's what makes him so lovable. Lucy Ricardo from I Love Lucy. Ricky, can I be on your show? No, Lucy. Wah. But she tries to scheme, tries to get on the show. She tries again and again and again. And eventually she gets on the show in several episodes. But what we love watching is the fact that she keeps trying and she goes through all these nutty schemes and absurd schemes to try to get on the show, right? And that's what makes her so interesting and makes us empathize with her. Wizard of Speed and Time, nobody's ever seen this movie except for a few weirdos like me, but it's
high on my list. I need to do with that still.
I linked to it in the Tumblr post to the YouTube playlist. I describe it as the Muppet Movie meets Pee-wee's Big Adventure. It's the story of a guy who's trying to make a movie, and every single obstacle gets in his way. He gets very frustrated. He sells his car. He's going to lose his house. He sells all of these old films that he's made, but he keeps on persevering. And even when the weather gets bad, and he finds out that his producer is actually scheming against him to try to get the film not made, so he won't lose a bet. But as stressed out as he gets, he always keeps punching. He always keeps like this kind of positive outlook. He's not like blindly optimistic, but it's always this, egads, we got to do it. We got to do the thing, right? And egads, this thing got in my way, and I got to keep on fighting for the thing. So he'd be the most optimistic member of this team, but I just imagined it as, you know, here's three people who lose a lot and are very comical about it, and they have to teach this person how to be a hero, and the story would probably, and I only wrote a paragraph about it, they'd probably fail, and that would be the critical moment in their failure in training this kid. That's the thing that makes her realize the lesson that they inadvertently taught, and then she becomes the hero. Very, very loose outline. But I don't think I'm going to do anything with this story, because as I looked at it, I was like, why the heck would these three characters be in a story together? It's a pretty odd mix. So, but it was instructive. It was instructive to look at my procedure of investigating a story from with a new quest, new creative challenge.
Sure. Well, playing with creative limitations and whatnot. And yeah. So you were surprised about the characters you put together?
Yeah. I thought I'd pick something that had some, like, the only glue that holds them together is the fact that they're all funny and they all fail. I couldn't even come up with a logical reason why these three characters would exist in the same world.
Yeah. Oh, so, yeah. I don't even know if I succeeded in that as well. But yeah, that's definitely like the harder, that's almost like a dissonant aspect of this exercise, is that we almost will end up trying to have the reason behind it. And my escape for that was, I'm just like, wow, they were fated. And in fact, like the whole thing that, you know, like, I'm actually recruiting people. Ha ha, I'm out of it. You know, that kind of thing. So it's, it was interesting. Interesting. And it was very cool. Like, I love that I enjoyed watching what came out of this and going through it and actually hearing about what happened in your class as well. And super informative for me for coming up with, and, you know, quests down the road too, where every single time I've been trying to make it be less of a, it's meant to be a mini challenge.
Yeah. Well, and that's why I think I came up with such a random assortment of characters, was because I was trying, I set a timer. I'm like, do not overthink this, dude. Just sit down, ask some questions of yourself, and belt out the ideas. Do what you tell your students to do, is just throw ideas on paper. Don't be precious. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I just thought of who are three people who fail, but I love them for failing. Boom. And that's what, so, you know, I think I invested about 2 hours total, but that was just because I'm slow to type up my thoughts on something. But yeah, I think that that's something that's a takeaway to bring to any of the future quests is even as they're constructed, the big idea is to, as much as we talk about this idea of being intentional and everything, don't overthink the quests, right?
Yeah, the intentional thing isn't like a permanent straitjacket. Right. it's really, I mean, I don't know, you're playing with and discovering your own reflexes as you do this kind of thing. And they do, you do end up changing and informing them by having an intentional practice. But, inherently, I just know that, as I practice this kind of, you know, just taking mini challenges or having deadlines a lot and running into that, I find that I end up trusting that I'm able to find a way through it. And that's one thing that's been a great takeaway.
It's a faith thing, having faith that your creativity will see you through. Right. So let me close out the quest bit by saying, okay, so you took on this challenge, maybe you took it on after the fact. Thank you to Lucas, by the way, for participating in this episode's quest number 6. Let's say you take it on after the fact and you're like, gosh, that was fun. I want to take this to the next level. I want to explore more of these ideas. So you, the leader, want to create stories with dynamic character interactions, interesting casts, emotionally resonant characters, emotionally dissonant characters. Then there's two dojos we have at leanintoart.com. And as a matter of fact, I should pull up the screen share real quick and hit that. So we go to leanintoart.com/workshops. Why is it not working? I think my computer's had enough. I'll try it again. Here we go. Start screen share. leanintoart.com/workshops, where you will find... Oh, I'm going to crash. There we go. For crying out loud. Creating compelling characters with Tyler James, which is a workshop on how to design compelling characters, how to write and to draw them, and to use both the visual and narrative aspects to communicate through comics, characters that people will care about. And then there's a 4-part series by Krishna Sadasivam, Creating Crazy Characters, which is a really in-depth one. I use the stuff he taught in this in my own classrooms all the time. I was just asked by a student yesterday, how do I draw a penguin resting his feet on a desk? And I said, well, if you think of a penguin as a pillow, and if you can draw a pillow resting in a chair that way, then you can draw a penguin that way. And it actually helped the kid out. And I learned that from Krishna Sadasivam. So creating crazy characters at leanintoart.com/workshops, and every workshop purchase comes with 12 hours of bonus content, including the Creative Topics Variety Pack with an improv story lab. Really, really cool stuff in there. So anyway, I wanted to make a mention of that as we close out this whole quest thing. Do I need to do another musical transition? I'll just go ahead and do this. Quest's over.
It does feel like we crossed the threshold now.
No quest for the next episode. We're going to take another break from the quest because, to be honest, it's because I'm under deadline for a couple different books right now, and I'm just not going to be able to give it the attention that it deserves. And B, because as we discover that these quests take more and more time, we're going to play with this idea of possibly doing them monthly rather than every episode, giving you guys a longer window to participate. Not everybody has the strength, determination, and courage of a Lucas Haig, right?
Yeah. That's, you know, if we ever wire this up with achievements or something, Lucas has unlocked some endurance and awesomeness.
So with that, I think we walked around this one pretty good, Rob.
I think we did. And I think we teased the future episode as well.
So
this business of art stuff. It all depends, right?
Thank you to Tyrell for providing us with the topic for this episode. You guys can go to leadintart.com, use the contact form to contact us with your own curveballs that may turn into the full episode or two. Couple quick announcements. I'm going to be at TCAF pretty soon. I think maybe by the time the next episode airs, I want to say it's in like a couple weeks, right? Oh, we got to look at the schedule. I don't know if I'm going to be able to do Lean Into Art on Thursday.
Adjust our recording schedule, no problem.
Yeah, But the Toronto Comics Arts Festival, I'm not tabling. I'm just going to be there. I'm going to be walking around. So if anyone wants to high five me, that's where you'll be able to find me. And then I also wanted to throw out a plug for comicsaregreat.com/AAday. May 14th is the release date for Dave Roman's Astronaut Academy. He was there in the chat today. That's not why I'm doing this, Dave. I had it intended to do this regardless. But there's a big contest I'm running on the Comics Great site. I get nothing out of this. I have not been put up to this by First Second Publishing or anybody else. I kind of blindsided Dave with this by saying, hey, guess what? I'm putting on a contest to help promote your book release. And what's in there? 1,000 pages of digital comics that you get, that you're entered to win. Original art by Kazu Kibuishi, original art by Rafael Rosado, original art by Chris Giarrusso, signed books by Chris Giarrusso. A Skype visit from me is a prize. An appearance on the Comics Are Great show is a prize. I'm putting my Comics Fundamentals course in there as a prize. An original portrait of you by Raina Telgemeier, New York Times bestselling author, award-winning cartoonist Raina Telgemeier will draw you. That's one of the prizes. How do you get these prizes? All you got to do is do a blog post about the Astronaut Academy comic at astronautacademy.com. And we're Dave serializing it for free before it comes out in atomic form, and then you won't be able to get it any other way afterwards. So go read the comic, write a blog post about it, write a review on Amazon or Goodreads, do a little fan art. Dave's comics or Dave's characters are immensely fun to draw. I guarantee you will not be sorry that you drew them. And then, or on the day of release, and I should say on the day of release, May 14th, get your picture taken with the book in a bookstore to say, hey, look, I'm getting the book. It's the release day. And share that stuff on Twitter with the Astronaut Academy Day tag, and you'll be entered to win one of those prizes.
This is awesome.
A lot of stuff in there, and a lot of cartoonists pledge their time and effort and materials to make this thing happen. So my thanks to everybody who's lending prizes. And here's the tease I want to throw in. Is the big one. If we can make it a trending topic on Twitter on the day of release, May 14th, I've got a crazy prize I will give away to one person. If we can make it a trending topic, I will give my digital edition of my comic PPV, pay-per-view, which is out of print. You can't get it anywhere unless you go find it in a long box someplace. And what comic store has long boxes anymore? Nobody. That's who. So you can't find this book. I will give everybody who participates a copy of that, a PDF of that book, this out of print book, if we can make it a trending thing. But then I've got one secret prize that is an awesome one that is crazy, and I'd be stupid to do it. But if we can make it a trending topic on Twitter on May 14th, I will select somebody who participates to get this crazy awesome thing. And that's all I'll say.
So intriguing, because like there's plenty of awesome already, dude.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome as is.
What
but
the heck?
comicsaregreat.com/AAday. Go check that out. And let's all turn this thing into a worldwide celebration of this book that's coming out that I love very much. And I know more people will too. That's why I'm putting all this energy behind it.
Super cool.
So Rob, fun.
Jersey.
We went a little long, but I think we needed to.
Yeah, we did. Sorry about the going too long, but sometimes these adventures and these quests and these podcasts, yeah, we can't foresee.
Yeah. You know, so, but it was a fun talk, and thanks to cool. Thanks to Dave Roman and Courtney Hahn and
Lucas
and everybody for hanging out in the chat room and participating with the show. This will be archived at leanintoart.com. We'll be back in two weeks at 9 p.m. Eastern time to do another live stream. You can participate live on the show with us. And if you like what you saw today, if you like what you listened to, a great way to thank us that doesn't cost a cent is to give us a thumbs up on YouTube or a star review on iTunes. That helps more people find out about this thing that you enjoyed in a nice, anonymous, relatively anonymous way. So thanks again, Rob. Until next time, everybody. I have been Jersey Drozd of leanintoart.com and Jersey on Twitter.
And I have been Rob Stenzinger of leanintoart.com and Rob Stenzinger on Twitter.
Okay, bye.
Show notes for this episode can be found at leanintoart.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at the user leanintoart, and you can reach us via email at leanintoart@gmail.com. And remember, leaners aren't wieners. Thanks for listening.